Taking a look now at your pet's health with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical professor in the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. Larry Mueller here. Really glad to have you listening in. And certainly if you have a question for us, I hope you'll join in. The number is 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us, and the email address is talk@wpr.org. And Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, welcome back.
It is nice to be back, Larry.
Pets in the news these days with the president.
President-elect has narrowed it down to two different types of dogs. One is the Portuguese water dog, which is a wonderful breed. I mean, they're active but non-shedding. They need to be groomed, so they have to have their hair cut periodically. Kind of a medium to large-sized dog, not as big as like a lab or something like that. So great dog. Very active, though, and I hope that they have the ability to get this dog swimming and, you know, running and playing. The other dog they're thinking about is the Labradoodle, which is a cross between a standard poodle and Labrador Retriever. And unfortunately, not all those dogs are non-shedding, so the White House may have a little bit of dog here to deal with. It just depends on which kind of how many generations out you're dealing with, because if you're dealing with a first-generation lab slash poodle, we see some of them that just have kind of a little bit wiry hair but shed like crazy. And remember, anytime you're getting anybody's adopting a dog, you got to do your homework and know health problems that they may have, questions to ask, you know, work with the breeders, and you know, don't just take the first dog that comes along. But you know, I'm kind of glad that he's getting a dog rather than some of the other pets.
There's some strange pets from our presidents.
I thought it would be really fun to look this stuff up, and I found out some really odd ones. Let's see. Martin Van Buren had two tiger cubs. Now, can you imagine those becoming popular as pets? John Quincy Adams had, believe it or not, an alligator. And Calvin Coolidge had a pet named Billy, and it happened to be a pygmy hippopotamus. So there you go. So I don't
think in the White House?
In the White House. So I don't think the Obamas are, you know, going to cause any waves at all with getting either of those dogs.
All right. Well, I tell you what, on that note, we're going to turn to Tammy and Marinette, who has a question for you. Tammy, hello.
Good morning, Larry. Good morning, Doctor.
Hi.
I have nothing as exciting as a hippopotamus question, but I have.
That's good, because I don't know anything about him.
What?
I don't know anything about hippopotamus, so yes, hippopotami, okay. I guess, yeah.
I have a medium hair cat, and she had started scratching under her chin, and I thought, okay, maybe we have a flea problem. I put a flea collar on her, and it did kind of stop that, but when I took the flea collar off, now she started scratching around her whiskers to the point where she actually has quite a substantial pock mark right there.
Hmm.
And I've been told that ear mites travel outside the ear, and I'm wondering if that would be the problem. I've tried, you know, store-bought ear mite solution.
Yeah.
Doesn't seem to really do
much
yeah.
good. Okay.
Yeah.
What do you think?
Yeah, you know, I think the one thing that you haven't done, though, is visit with your veterinarian. And I think that really needs to be done. First of all, for cats with fleas, you're kind of right in that cats, because they're such efficient groomers, the best place to look for fleas and actually see evidence of them is usually on the front half of their body, where they may not be doing as much grooming up by their head. But you do, typically with fleas and flea allergy dermatitis, you'll see evidence of the fleas feeding. The flea droppings, which is just digested blood, looks like little kind of black peppery type stuff in the hair coat. So you can use a flea comb. They sell them commercially. Your little flea trivia is it's 32 teeth per inch on the comb, and that's what will trap live fleas. And you can run it through her hair coat and see if you can find them.
She's a white cat. I've never seen anything.
Yeah, so very unlikely that it's fleas. Ear mites tend to cause a kind of black, crumbly, dry discharge in the ear. They're very itchy. Usually both ears are involved, although I have been fooled and seen one ear worse than the other.
Mm-hmm.
Ear mites are visible on a swab if you take it and look under a microscope on a glass slide.
Mm-hmm.
They're very tiny little critters with little legs crawling around. Cats get ear mites from contact with other cats. And so if your cat has been an indoor-outdoor cat, around strays, anything like that, new to your household, then that would be something that should be investigated. Although most cats will not scratch their face, but will actually scratch their ears and make their ears, you know, scabby and sore. So
I mean, I've cleaned her ears with the Q-tip, and all I see is black waxy things in her ears.
So it may not be ear mites. When I hear facial itching, a few things that come to mind. One, make sure that you check the teeth. Sometimes cats with dental disease will paw at their mouth and have some problems that way. So if she's got any gingivitis, root exposure, the cavities that we see in cats called neck lesions or erosive lesions, those would be all things that your veterinarian could inspect to make sure that there isn't a problem. We'll sometimes see cats get acne, which is blackheads and pimples on their chin and around their lips that can make it itchy too, especially if they get infected, which they can. So, be on the lookout for something like that. And the other thing that I think of when I think of facial itching, where cats actually mutilating their face, is allergic disease. And sometimes food allergies or environmental allergies. And so this is why I think rather than just throwing things that you can find over the counter, which may just be delaying the diagnosis and proper treatment, I think it's time to get her in her carrier, call your veterinarian and say, I need to come in and have this skin looked at. And they'll be able to help you pretty quick, I think.
And good luck. And thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And Catherine and Madison, we'll turn to you next. Hi, Catherine.
Hi there. Good morning.
Good morning.
My question is there any telltale sign that one has purchased a puppy from a puppy mill? We recently purchased a Norwich Terrier, and I'm just a little bit concerned about that.
Well, I think things that would be kind of alarms that would go off would be not being allowed to see the kennel and the breeding area, and not being able to meet mom or dad, or mom preferably, and mom and dad even better. And I've had several clients that have purchased pets where the pet has been delivered to them. They've met at like a mall parking lot, and they've had several dogs in cages in the back. Those should be big alarms. I can tell you another thing. My veterinary technician that is, been a vet tech for many, many years and is excellent at working with pets, she got asked by her parents to help them find a new dog. And they had been looking for, certain breeds and so on. And so they followed up on an ad in the newspaper, and she went with them and brought her stuff scope because she can listen to hearts too, and wanted to just make sure, since it was a breed that is at risk of having some heart disease, have a listen to these dogs. As soon as that stethoscope came out, the owner of the kennel started yelling at them and said, I'm just calling the cops and get out of here. That's a little alarm going off,
Okay. I think we're okay.
Yeah. Pet store puppies, most of them are probably going to be from puppy mills as well. People that are breeding and then selling them commercially through a pet store. I typically tell people, avoid pet stores, work with a kennel or a breeder that is going to grill you just as much as you're going to be grilling them. They want to make sure that those dogs are placed in the right environment. My little rule of thumb with dealing with a good breeder is, guess what kind of guarantee you should get? Lifetime. Okay. Anytime you can't keep that dog for whatever reason it may be, whether, you've got to go in the hospital or you've got, kids with allergies or whatever, they will take it back and find an appropriate home for it. It's not going to become a burden on society. That's the sign of a good breeder.
Oh, okay, very good. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for calling, Catherine. Appreciate it. And Sandra in Oregon, we'll go to you now. Hi, Sandra.
Hello. I have a couple questions today, and I'll try not to be too long-winded here. I have a rescue dog that I've had for 2 years. She has, from day one, been extremely terrified, unsocialized, and just very fearful. I started working with a behaviorist probably 6 months into it, and she was on medication for a while. But I'm at a point now where I haven't gotten very far with her, and the last instructions that I was given from the behaviorist was to try to get her to move from room to room with me, and she has never been able to do that. She is terrified of being tied up anyway or leashed. Right now I'm trying to carry her from room to room. I know that that's not the answer, but I'm looking for some way to start getting her to move from room to room.
Oh, boy. And this is why it's so critical to get dogs socialized early. And I'm so happy that you've taken on this type of problem with having a rescue dog. But, this is one of the reasons why, the American Veterinary Society, Behavior Society, is now recommending that puppies start training classes and socialization classes as early as 7 to 8 weeks of age. After that first inoculation, get them into training class. That's how critical it is. These are the national guidelines now. And so now here you've got a dog that who knows what her background is.
She was 2 years old when I got her.
Yeah,
so
you know,
already not socialized.
Right.
Yeah.
And you know, and please don't take this the wrong way, but sometimes that lack of socialization and you know, being in an enriched environment and exposed to lots of things, they almost become brain damaged. And some of these dogs, it is not reversible. And you can only get them to a certain point, and you may just have to accept them as they are. I have a rescue cat that's like that, that maybe I can touch every month or two, you know. And I've just accepted it that, you know, that's as far as I can get with her, and she's leading a very happy, safe life, but, you know, in my home with not a lot of human contact. You know, things that you could try, I would not be recommending carrying your dog because that's training her to always be looking for chauffeur service. But if she's got, and I'm sure the trainer's worked with you with this, you have to find something that your dog is absolutely passionate about, whether it be a squeaker toy, some certain food like turkey or, you know, freeze-dried liver or something, so that you can get her attention and you start, you know, very small with maybe just, you know, baby steps, having her move like 1 foot forward and reward her. This would be a perfect situation for clicker training and, you know, target training. And I don't know if the trainer has worked with you with that, but sometimes just doing those little teeny baby steps where she just moves 1 foot an inch and you click and reward and she's like, wow, move an inch, you get something. And gradually it's going to be, you know, she moves her whole body and she gets rewarded. And you just keep adding to each of those behaviors. So if you haven't started working with someone that does that type of training, I think that might not be a bad idea.
Yeah.
One last question. Are there local resources for me? I'm at a point right now where I can't spend the extra money to work directly with a behaviorist. Are there some local resources for me to talk to somebody about this? Because she is I've touched the surface. She's an extremely, extremely fearful case.
Yeah. There's a woman that's kind of the matriarch of the click and training, clicker training type training. Her name's Karen Pryor, and she has a book on the market. It's been out for years. It's called Don't Shoot the Dog. You may want to look at getting that or some of the other things that are out there. Those would probably be your best resources. If you can't actually work with the person, you know, getting some of the videos or, you know, materials that are available to help teach you the training method. But it is a little tricky because you have to get the timing just perfect. And it may still be worth just even having like one session with an in-house trainer, because obviously your dog is not a candidate for going to a group class.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think, you know, I don't know, maybe, you know, talk to the various rescue groups and things like that around and just see if they have anybody that would be maybe willing to help you. But it is going to take someone really well-versed in conditioning like that.
And thanks very much for calling. Talking Your Pet's Health with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical professor in the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Taking your calls about your pet's health here on the Ideas Net with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, Larry Mueller here. Mark in Lafarge is up next, so we'll go to Mark. Hi, Mark.
Good morning.
Morning. Good morning.
Detective Sawchuk, I have another one for you.
Okay.
And I've experienced this before, so I'm going to guess that it's not incredibly uncommon. But I have a cat that has a twitch.
Okay.
And this happened 10 years ago with another cat. Its back is visibly twitching.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very, very irritating to the cat. It runs around thinking that there's something on its back, trying to get away from it.
Yeah,
and there's not much I can do to distract him.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering what the causation is and if there's anything I can do about it.
Well, I tell you what, you could be looking up. And this is kind of one of these funny syndromes. All cats will twitch their back normally. They have a nervous system response called the paniculus response. Horses have it, cows have it, to be able to get flies off of them. And if you just touch any animal's back, they'll kind of do a little twitch. It's involuntary. And so it's, you know, they're hardwired to be able to do this, but when they do it to excess and they're actually distressed by it, running, some of these cats will even almost hallucinate, like there's, you know, something in the air after them as well. The name of this syndrome in cats is called feline hyperesthesia syndrome, which just means cat oversensitivity syndrome. You will find it written, if I went into the veterinary literature, you'd find it written up in veterinary dermatology books. And the veterinary dermatologists will say, you know, rule out skin issues like, you know, external parasites, allergies, you know, anything like that. You'll see it written up in the neurology books as well. And they think it's some type of a focal seizure disorder or a neuropathy that's triggering this. And so sometimes they'll approach it from, you know, the nervous disease standpoint. You'll also see it written up in behavior books. And in some behavior books, this is classified as a compulsive disorder. And they feel that this is just something these cats do over and over and over again. And I had a cat in just recently that had been bit over his back, had an injury there, and then started doing exactly the same behavior that you're describing. You know, just to the point where it was not living a normal life. It was spending more time doing this type of behavior. And we ended up starting that cat on Paxil as a psychoactive drug. And the cat has done phenomenally well. And we're now weaning him off, and the behavior has not started to come back. So whether this was just something that was triggered by the bite, I don't know. But response to therapy, and the cat's now leading a normal life. So those would be the things we'd be looking at. Is it neurologic? Is it dermatologic? And then, you know, dealing it with from the behavior standpoint and medical management.
Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Kevin in Burnsville, Minnesota, is it, Kevin?
Hello.
Hello.
See, I got about a 15-year-old cat, and lately she's been starting to pull her fur.
Mm-hmm.
And also I noticed when she goes to the bathroom, all of a sudden, you know, number two or whatever you want to call it, but then she takes off running all over the place. Could there be something going wrong there?
We'll talk about the litter box habits to start with. A lot of times as cats get older, 15-year-old cats, they can have various problems that can affect their water balance, things like chronic kidney disease, hyperthyroidism, and so on. And this can make them be more prone to being constipated, having harder, drier stools. So sometimes the pain in passing a firmer stool can cause the cat to run from the box. Their response is, I got to get away from the thing that's painful. The other thing we'll see is there's these two little scent glands on either side of the rectum that in normal, you know, cats, young cats, the discharge out of there is usually very runny and liquidy. And when they have a normal BM, they get just compressed against the muscle tissues back there, and the contents are expelled onto the stool. As cats get older, that discharge becomes thicker and very pasty, almost cement-like. In fact, I had a cat in the other day. We had to anesthetize to be able to flush it and get it emptied out because it was just like a rock in there. And that can sometimes cause a cat to be painful when they're defecating as well. Instead of them emptying, there's pressure on them and it's painful and they run. So that would be the easiest thing to do is take your kitty in along with some representative stool samples so your vet can see a fresh stool sample. And cats don't necessarily have to endure a rectal like dogs do. You can express their anal glands externally. So that would be my first thing that I would want to be looking at. Regarding why she's pulling her hair out, you know, if it's just an older cat that's not able to groom effectively and she's matting and it's pulling and it's uncomfortable, it may be that you just have to hike up your grooming. But there may be other things that are causing her some pain and discomfort too that's forcing her to want to lick at herself and pull her hair. So again, when she's in having her rear end checked, they can have a look at her hair coat too and maybe come up with some suggestions for you.
And good luck and thank you very much for your call. Bob emailed in and wonders, what is the current thinking in regard to when to wean a puppy?
Oh, well, good question. Sometimes moms decide that. But typically, you know, we like to see the dogs beginning to, you know, socialize, like I said, starting about 7 to 8 weeks of age, getting them, you know, around other dogs and so on, as long as they're vaccinated and healthy. So obviously they need to be weaned before then. I like to see puppies start receiving some solid foods when they're about 4 weeks of age. I have a litter right now of a family with German Shepherd puppies, and they're already eating some solid food and they're 3.5 weeks of age. So sometimes it's kind of based on how the puppies are developing, but 3.5, 4 weeks, starting them on gruel of, you know, some type of puppy formula mixed with either dog formula or water. Don't use milk, that can cause diarrhea, and you know, just let the puppies kind of fall in it and get it on their lips, and before long they'll be giving mom a break and eating on their own.
Let's go to Sally in Wayland, Minnesota next. Sally, hello to you.
Hello, and hello, Doctor.
Hello.
It's another beautiful day in southeastern Minnesota. The sun is shining and the wind isn't blowing, so all is good.
Good for you.
Yeah. I have a goat, a dairy goat. Her name is Mighty Isis.
Okay.
She's fat. She's alert. She's strong, beautiful. She looks great. Her ears are up. She's very alert. And she's, goats are really jokers. You know, mm-hmm. She has quite a personality.
Uh-huh.
She's pregnant. That might be a concern in this. But I officially put her on maternity leave a couple of days ago. I told the other goats, Billy and the kids, they had to go out and get jobs because she supported the herd.
Okay.
She's on maternity leave now.
Okay.
What I'm worried about or wondering about, last night it got down to like minus 25 degrees.
Yeah, yeah.
And, yeah, I know that goats have a really nice, fluffy, almost down like a layer of fur underneath their outside fur.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I know that she's plenty warm. She's fine. They don't seem to mind that, and they have good shelter. But she's rubbing and rubbing and rubbing against her neck, and it's actually it's worn off all of her fur on one side.
Uh-huh.
So it's not like she's down to like being bald. It's not like she has a bald neck.
Yeah.
But it's cut it down. It's like trimmed it down to like maybe a half inch. And
wow.
I thought, man, you know, you're worried about her being pregnant and everything and getting too cold and whatnot. And I was just wondering, is there something wrong, and can I treat her while she's pregnant?
Well, you have to be really careful with certain drugs, and especially with parasite treatments and so on. Every drug that's out there will have it listed as to whether it's, you know, safe for use in pregnant animals or not. So if you don't have that information, your veterinarian can definitely get that information for you. You know, I'd be worried this time of the year because animals tend to be in more close contact with things like lice and so on. So having a close look at these areas to see if you can find any louse nits or other, you know, parasites. But I'm not sure why she would be rubbing her neck. Did she have a collar on that could have been a little more irritating for her?
Yeah, all the goats have a collar just because it makes them easier to handle.
Yeah.
But this is actually probably above and below her collar, and it's just on one side. But if she has lice, I wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah, yeah.
The Billy and the kids, they came from a non-dairy farm.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And so, and this would be something that, you know, working with your veterinarian there to find a safe thing that you can use. Now, most of the products that we use on our patients, dogs and cats, that I work out with my small animal practice, are, you know, fairly safe if you're using something like a pyrethrin, that is just kind of, you know, a very minor thing, kind of like what we use on our own hair if we develop head lice. That would probably be very safe to use. But again, this would be something that I just the other day had to look up because I was dealing with a dog that's nursing, and can I use this drug that since she's producing milk and nursing puppies? I didn't know. And I use this as a drug I use every day, and I had to look it up. So, you know, have someone or you do your homework before you just start grabbing stuff and treating her.
Yeah, good luck. Thank you very much for your call. Erica emailed us, Sandy, and says we have a dog that we've been treating for hypothyroidism with our vet since May of 2008. Breuer is a 5-year-old chow golden retriever mix. He's not been able to hold down the medication. He's had diarrhea, vomiting, general discomfort. He's restless. Our vet advised we had on vet's advice, excuse me, we had blood work done to see if the meds were too strong. They were fine. Blood work came back perfect. The vet recommended we switch manufacturers of the drug. We've done that. It hasn't helped. What are we missing, or what is our vet missing? We took him off the medication for about a week, and he was 100% better. Put him back on, and he was vomiting the same day. So we think we verified it was the meds.
Yeah.
But could it be another disease that we missed?
Yeah, yeah. You know, diagnosing hypothyroidism, unfortunately, it's one of those things where it does sometimes take more than just doing a simple thyroid test. We usually have to do a thyroid panel and kind of look at the results. And just making sure that, one, you have the right diagnosis. Yes, definitely the symptoms would go along with sometimes if we are making a pet hyperthyroid, they will vomit and have diarrhea. So I think your vet was right on with checking that thyroid value to make sure that it was still within the normal range and you weren't overdosing your dog. I'm really at a loss. I don't know whether this would be a medication that you could get formulated in, like, you know, have it in food so that it's not going into an empty stomach, kind of, you know, playing with it that way. I have never had a pet not tolerate thyroid medication, unless it was the wrong diagnosis or they were being overdosed with the medication. So, you know, it sure sounds like you've almost fulfilled Koch's postulates by, you know, taking him off and redoing it again and just seeing if, you know, you could, you know, replay the whole thing again. I don't know what to say. You know, this would be a case where I would be recommending that your veterinarian contact our internal medicine people that deal with endocrinology cases. The vet school has a full, you know, group of specialists there, and some of them deal with more hormonal problems than others, but I'm sure they can find somebody and can just have your veterinarian call. There is an 800 number for the vet school. It's 1-800-DVM, like Doctor of Veterinary Medicine, VMTH, which stands for Veterinary Medical Teaching Hospital, or just locally 263-7600.
All right. Bob in Stoughton, your turn now. Hi, Bob.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Sandy.
Hi.
We have a Dalmatian Golden Retriever male. He's about 8 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And my wife thinks he drinks too much water.
Okay.
He's maybe 3 quarts a day, maybe a little more.
That sounds a lot. It depends on how much he weighs.
He weighs between 80 and 90 pounds.
Okay. So I usually measure, I mean, almost everything we do in the veterinary world is done in, using the metric system. And so the, you know, typical water intake for a dog that we would consider kind of normal range would be about 60 mils per kilogram per day. So what does that equate? I'd have to sit down and pull my calculator out and do that. But most of your measuring cups are going to have mils on there as well. And remember, 2.2 pounds per kilogram. So take your dog's weight and divide it by 2.2. When we start getting anywhere like 80 to 100 mils per kilogram per day, we get a little concerned that, yeah, that's a little high. Anything over 100, they're definitely drinking too much water. Some dogs are just water hounds. They like to drink it. But in a middle-aged to older, especially large breed dog like this, and this, if this is a new problem, it's just started, it does warrant some investigation. So what I would recommend is before you go to your vet, do a little water study. Measure out how much he's, you know, in the bowl. Use a measuring cup and keep tabs over, and do this for several days for, you know, just to account for like kind of daily fluctuations. Take that information into your veterinarian and take your dog in with a full bladder, okay? Because getting a urine sample is going to be really helpful. May also be helpful if, along with that piece of paper with how much your dog's actually drinking, you catch just a free catch first morning urine sample. If your dog is kenneled at night or doesn't have access to water in the middle of the night, sleeping all night long, that's going to be the time when the urine is the most concentrated. And
so the 5 o'clock saddle, huh?
Okay. Yeah. So, yeah. So you go out there and you follow them along, collect it, no snow in it, okay? Collect a little urine, bring that along with you, and then, you know, make sure that he doesn't lift his leg or go on any trees outside the clinic, because there's nothing worse than needing a fresh urine sample and the dog just went, and then we have to have you come back again. So, you know, that would be very helpful. And I think they maybe will get to the bottom of this if you do that.
Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. You can join in, too, with your question about your dog or your cat's issue with Dr. Sandy at 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at talk@wpr.org. And, Sandy, we have Liz from Dodgeville who emailed a 10-month-old lab, excuse me, who likes to eat a lot of things that aren't not meant to be food. Wonders if this is a deficiency sign or just if the dog's just curious.
It's a puppy. You know, this is why when you get a dog, you really need to puppy-proof your house. Everything goes in their mouth. Bark outside. You know, we've taken rocks out of dog's stomachs, golf balls. You name it, we've taken it out of a dog's stomach. So keeping your house, you know, picked up and clean, everything up out of the way, and then giving your dog safe things to be able to work on in the house. So you know, if you don't have enough things around, I'm sure you do, living with a puppy, you know, appropriate toys that they can chew on. And I love the toys that I kind of call the interactive toys, the ones that maybe dispense food. One of my favorite companies is one called Premier Pets, and they make a whole line of things where you can, you know, unwind it, put food in it, and twist it together again. They make a toy called the Tug-a-Jug, which is really unique, that has a, it's got a rope and a bottle, and they have to get the food out. And that may keep your dog, since if it's a lab, they're probably very food motivated. That way they'll play with that and leave your TV remote control alone. So hopefully that'll, you know, he'll outgrow this if you keep him directed at the appropriate things.
Mike in Appleton, your turn now. Hi, Mike. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have two questions. We just adopted a yellow lab puppy not too long ago. She's about 5.5 months now. And one concern I have is just, you know, as she grows older, her hips and, you know, how they're going to develop. And besides just general nutrition and exercise, what are other options? I mean, I've heard of, you know, vitamin C tablets. Do those work? And then my second question is, she still has her dew claws. And do they need to be removed or not?
Oh, a couple of really good questions here. You know, first of all, when you're purchasing a dog like this, a large breed dog, where hip dysplasia can be more of a common problem, make sure you're dealing with a reputable breeder that is having their dogs screened for hip disease. So you'd be looking at either what's called PENN, hip, P-E-N-N, hip certification, or another thing called OFA certification, which stands for Orthopedic Foundation for Animals. That's a good way to kind of, you know, try to get genetics out of it a little bit. But even with that, we can still see some, you know, puppies still in the litter having this, because there is some environmental factors that can lead to dogs having abnormal joint development. Over-supplementation, adding in calcium, over-supplementing their diet is definitely one of the big risks. So staying with a large breed formula for growth is important, rather than just an all-purpose puppy food, which is might have too much energy and too many minerals in it. Those foods tend to push dogs to grow too quickly, and they kind of, for lack of a better way of explaining it, their, you know, blood supply and soft tissue structures can't keep up with the bone development, and you'll end up getting some changes in the femoral head and neck and so on. So right diet is definitely indicated. The other thing is keeping her lean. They found many dogs that are either free-fed or allowed to get fat in that first year of life, besides living less, meaning living, you know, 15% less if they're allowed to stay overweight. And I'm not talking like coffee table on legs overweight. I'm talking just a little bit overweight. We body condition score dogs on a scale of 1 to 9, with 1 being the emaciated, very thin dog, and 9 being the coffee table on with legs. So if we keep our dogs at 4 to 5, they have a much less chance of developing osteoarthritis and problems down the road as they get older. Just let them become a 6, little bit overweight, you dramatically increase that risk. So keep her lean, no hard pounding exercise for the first year of life or so until those joints develop.
All right. Well, she loves to run, obviously, but she's real small for a lab. We're not expecting her to be much more than 55 pounds.
She's still considered a large breed dog. So,
okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I to get, you know, another opinion from you, we're feeding her Canidae.
Okay.
I don't know if that is too much of what you were talking about.
Well,
the all-purpose.
Yeah, I mean, I still I think that there's other foods out there that I would prefer to use for large breed dogs. And I know that they say that that's kind of an all-purpose formula for, you know, all sizes of dogs, puppies and adults. But I think that you'd be better off using a growth formula that is specific for, you know, large breed dogs. And they even have some foods out now that are designed for Labrador retrievers. You know, they have the extra fatty acids to help support their coat and, you know, keeping it nice and glossy. And, you know, it's usually their lower calorie foods because they have a tendency to get overweight more easily. So there's lots of foods like that out there. And I think you could do better.
All right. Okay. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate the call. Let's see. We had heard from Phil, and Luann sent us an email. Let's see. We have a question about our dog. He's a large mixed dog, about 11 years old. We've been snowshoeing on our property. He goes with us every day. He's developed a limp, doesn't run like he would like. We're wondering if we can give him ibuprofen, aspirin, or Tylenol.
Ooh, Ooh. Good questions. And no, I'm going to say no right away. Yeah, you know, 11-year-old large dog that's out there, you know, you've got those snowshoes on, so you're trudging along, and I bet you feel the exercise. Imagine with him falling through the snow and trying to keep up. He's probably putting a lot of stress on those old joints. So, you know, you may have to modify the exercise where you don't go out as long so he doesn't get that stiff and sore. But things that you would want to consider using, one, don't use Tylenol. Ibuprofen is the big risk with using ibuprofen is the therapeutic dose is very close to the toxic dose. We tolerate it. Dogs don't. Aspirin, extremely high risk of causing gastric ulcers. So there are many veterinary-approved, dog-tested anti-inflammatories on the market, non-steroidal anti-inflammatories. And there's every major drug manufacturer that makes veterinary drugs has one. There's at least half a dozen ones to choose from. And some tolerate those better than others. Other things that I'd be looking at is maybe consider getting your dog on a joint diet. Two companies, Nestle Purina and Hill's, both have their joint-specific diets that have essential fatty acids in it to help the inflammatory response in the joints. They have extra glucosamine and so on. Even those diets, though, benefit from having a joint supplement added like glucosamine and chondroitin sulfate. And those are readily available through your vet or, you know, online or even over the counter. So there's some things to consider trying.
Judy and Racine will give you a chance now. Hi, Judy.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
We have a 9-month-old golden retriever from a reputable breeder. And about at 6 months, we noticed that he was limping on a walk and actually would sometimes just lie down, not at all like a puppy.
Mm-hmm.
And took him into the vet and had x-rays, and they diagnosed him with panosteitis.
I could guess that. All right. Yeah.
Well, and I'm thinking now, did we give him the all-purpose puppy food that you were just talking about? We used the puppy food that he came home with from the breeder, but... And
I don't think for panosteitis, we really know if there's a strong nutritional component. What this is it's an inflammatory change that occurs in the shaft of the bone.
Mm-hmm.
And these dogs, and it's typically a shifting leg lameness. They'll start out on one leg and then they'll go to another.
Yeah.
And they're just depressed and they're painful. These are cases that it's managed with tincture of thyme and pain medication. It's kind of like growing pains.
Mm-hmm,
I had a basset hound about the same age that developed this as well. Mm-hmm. And it was really, I mean, she literally could not walk because, you know, she could not walk on three legs because of her body conformation with the short legs. And it was really difficult for me to watch her go through this, but it's probably nothing that you have done. But I think, you know, working with, you know, pain management and so on, that's really all you're going to be able to do.
And we were told that this is a self-limiting.
Once it's
an adult, it'll be all gone. And also, we were told, and I'm wanting to check with you, if there is a problem, any harmful side effects from the anti-inflammatories. He has had two regimes of it and seemed to be quite comfortable with it. And then it must stay in his system for quite a while because he was... you know, seeming to be fine, and now he's starting to limp again, and we're thinking, okay, we probably ought to take him back
But remember, it could be another reason why he's limping as well. So he may need to go back, and if they're not finding pain in the same area over the shaft of the bones, I just had a little golden retriever in that ended up having its shoulders x-rayed because we found shoulder pain, and it has a totally different problem called osteochondritis desiccans. So your dog could have a different juvenile type of orthopedic disease, and that needs to be looked into. So the anti-inflammatories don't stay in the system that long. Just like if you take an aspirin today, it's not in your system for, you know, days afterwards.
Right.
These big side effects we see with those medications, number one would be gastrointestinal upset, you know, vomiting, nausea, diarrhea, especially if you give it without food. When they get overdosed with this medication, you can see complications with liver and kidney problems. So you always want to make sure, since those are chewable tablets usually, that you keep them up and out of the way. I've had several owners leave them on the counter, dog knocks them down, eats the whole bottle.
Mm-hmm.
So keep them out of the way because they're very toxic if taken in too high high a level. And there's rare, just like with people, you know, every medication has kind of rare side effects,
mm-hmm.
rare reports of dogs developing liver problems, even on like, appropriate doses. So typically, if dogs have to be on these medications for long-term use, we'll do what we call an NSAID profile, where we look at some lab work, look at liver values, and see how the dog is tolerating it before we start going with it long-term.
And thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical professor at the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. Our guest, I'm Larry Mueller, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Looking at your pet's health today with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk. And I tell you what, we've got plenty of emails here, Sandy. One from Patricia, who says, my dog Rocky is a client of yours, and because he's extremely nervous, or was, he was put on Prozac along with behavior modification, and he's doing very well. Many people who I tell that he's on Prozac think I've done a terrible thing to him. Could you talk about the real effect of on a dog's physical and emotional stability when properly treated with Prozac?
Well, I know Rocky and I know Patricia, and you know, Rocky was one of these dogs that was absolutely, I mean, his life was miserable. He was so terrified of everything around him. He couldn't enjoy life. And he is now a new dog where he's, you know, and believe me, she's tried to take him off of the medication and he gets right back into some of his behaviors that are kind of more self-destructive, where he just isn't a happy boy. So, you know, yes, it's, you know, but you look at how many human beings have to have drugs like this to be able to function. And, you know, dogs can't tell us. And so when an owner recognizes that, you know, the dog is not doing the things they would normally do, is, you know, in Rocky's case, it was, you know, severe separation anxiety, and he, you know, just could never be left alone. And now he's a much happier boy. So, yeah.
I'm thinking back to one of our first calls with the woman who actually had to carry her dog mm-hmm. from one room to the other. Would something like Prozac have worked there?
It may. But remember, any time we're using psychoactive drugs, they're always linked with behavior modification. Just asking your veterinarian to give your dog a drug is not going to cure them. Okay,
yeah.
It has to be done along with training. And mm-hmm. there's many behavior problems that can be dealt with without drugs. But sometimes they're just so severe, we can't even get past that hump. And so we have to look at using some type of an anti-anxiety medication. Prozac may be one that would work for that dog. There may be other ones that would be, you know, just as effective as well. The two licensed drugs for dogs now that are on the market are fluoxetine or dog Prozac. Goes by the brand name of, I think it's called Reconcile. The Eli Lilly company makes it. And then we also have another one that is clomipramine, and it's also available in a human generic form as well. So, yeah,
all
it's
right.
called Clomacom in the dog world. Yep.
Shirley in Waupun, your turn now. Hi, Shirley.
Hello there. I have a question about a breed of cat.
Okay.
I visited my friend over the holidays, and she had just gotten a new cat. It's the strangest coloration I have ever seen. Looks to me like a weasel.
Okay.
But the head doesn't. I mean, it's definitely a cat. But so I finally asked her, what, you know, breed
uh-huh.
is it? And she said, oh, she said, it's a ragamuffin.
Oh,
so I
okay.
figured she's pulling my leg,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
And I looked in the dictionaries and everywhere else. And anyway, is there such a breed?
Well, there's rag dolls, and I believe there, you know, I'm saying this, yes, I think there are. Is there any ragamuffin people out there? Yeah. They have come out with so many new breeds of cats that, and I haven't been to a cat show in, I hate
oh, wow.
to say it, 2 or 3 years, okay? And a lot can happen at that point of time. So I know there's rag dolls. Now, can
kitties
some,
that are called rag dolls.
Rag dolls, yes, okay.
Yeah. She's beautiful.
Yeah,
the coloring is.
Yeah. But if someone's out there that knows ragamuffins, or maybe Larry can even pull it up on the computer
I
while we're talking. All right. And because now you stumped the veterinarian here. Okay.
Shirley, I'll give a look and stay listening. We'll see what we can come up with.
Okay.
Thanks for calling. Nathan in Whitlaw, it's your turn. Hi, Nathan.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. Thank you for calling.
I have a Border Collie lab mix. She's about 3 years old, and she's been chasing shadows for the last couple of years, and I just don't know how to get her from chasing shadows.
Oh, you know, and this is, it's, having that, herding dog instinct, it seems like we've got a lot of stuff on compulsive disorders being discussed in this show today, but that is one of the more common ones that we'll see. We'll see dogs do things like chronically chase their tail. I had one dog chasing its tail to the point where one had got it bloodied, but it was in our exam room and it cracked its head on the bench that people sit on, the wooden bench, and then just kind of shook himself and then got up and kept chasing it again. Shadow chasing, light chasing, you know, going after little flecks of light and things, very common compulsive disorder for, especially for herding dogs. Things that you can do, see if you can recognize the triggers for this. Sometimes anxiety, stressors in the dog's life, like you're getting ready to leave, the dog may start shadow chasing as a way of, you know, getting into the shadow chasing high rather than thinking about what's going to happen, that it's going to be left alone. So be looking at dealing with the underlying behavior problems. But if this has been going on for this length of time, most of these compulsive disorders will usually start when the dog's reaching puberty, about a year of age or so, and then, you know, keep progressing and getting worse. If it's interfering with your dog's life, especially if you can't call your dog off and have it do another behavior, then I'd be thinking about, it seems like all I'm talking about is psychoactive drugs, but this would be a perfect case for using something like Prozac.
Mm-hmm. All right. Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. And I did go online, and there is a ragamuffin breed.
There is. Okay.
There's even a ragamuffin, some ragamuffin organizations.
Wow. Well, there we go. Well, it's going to be a cat breed I'm going to have to look up. So, yeah.
It's a pretty kitty.
Is it? Okay.
Very pretty kitty.
Yeah.
All right. Will in Colfax, your turn. Hi, Will.
Hi. I have a question about a cat.
Okay.
We have a cat that's... has this kind of like stuffy nose and runny eyes, and then we've had her into the vet, and she's been on, different kinds of antibiotics for varying amounts of time. But it seems to, the vet said that if it was like a sinus infection, it's really hard to get the antibiotic into that area to clear it up.
And, right.
I was wondering if there's any sort of product that you know of that works really good on that sort of situation, or it's become a chronic thing.
Yeah. Most of these cats that develop this chronic rhinitis, it's usually because they've been exposed as a kitten to various viruses, which have caused damage to the filtering devices or the turbinates in their nose and causes scarring. And then you end up with getting secondary bacterial infections, and you can treat them with antibiotics and then it'll come right back again. And you can treat them again, it comes right back again. It's kind of one of those chronic things because you're dealing with, you know, structural issues in the nose. A few things that you could try before, you may want to consider having what I like to affectionately call the nasal extravaganza, but done to your cat. One thing would be talk to your veterinarian about using lysine. Lysine is an amino acid that's used as a supplement that interferes with some of the viral replication. It's not going to deal with problems that are bacterial, but if you've got something like a chronic herpes case, and remember, cat herpes is not transmissible to people, that might be helpful. And it's very safe to use. It comes in powders and gels and tablets and so on, and it's usually used one or two times a day, and it might be worth trying. Then what you'd be looking at is probably going to a specialist to have your cat evaluated. What they would likely do is, besides doing a physical exam on your cat and making sure that they're retrovirus tested, which means negative for feline leukemia virus and FIV, they would probably be then doing a CAT scan, a computerized axial tomography, not a, you know, cat as in meow cat, CAT scan on your cat's skull to look at the nasal passages. And then they'd probably be doing some flushing and collecting some of the material out of there for culture and cytology. That does require general anesthesia. It's a little bit of outlay on money, but sometimes that will give you some answers and maybe help you with knowing whether this is something you're going to have to be addressing the rest of your cat's life.
All right. Good luck. Pat in East Troy, your turn. Hi, Pat.
Hi. I have a golden retriever who is probably between 12 and 13 years old and has had health problems all the time that I've had him. He mm-hmm. was a rescue in 01 when we guessed he was 5 or 6.
Okay.
His latest one is that he had an inflamed eye inner lid, mm-hmm. and I took him to the regular vet, and he put him on Vetropolisin HC.
Okay.
And it was supposed to be for 5 days, but it didn't look any better after 5 days, and it was just before Christmas, so I just kept right on putting it in.
Yeah.
And nothing improved, so I was advised to take him to a veterinarian eye specialist.
Okay.
Who diagnosed it as being an ulcer.
Okay.
And I can see it.
So the medication he was on, which had a corticosteroid in it, was a totally incorrect medication for an ulcer. That combination of drugs with corneal damage, like an ulcer is actually a hole in the cornea, delays healing and can make the corneal ulcer worse. So you did exactly the right thing, and that it wasn't getting better like it was supposed to. The only thing you did is you went a little bit longer, but you're right, it was around Christmas time, so I don't blame you. But I'm glad your dog's being treated right now. I have a dog too, my own dog, Vanna. Her full name is Vanna White Trash, but that's all right. She is in the hospital right now because she has a non-healing corneal ulcer, and she had to have a contact lens put on yesterday. So she's comes to work with me so I can keep her quiet and not rough house with her brother who gave her the ulcer. So, so these things can be tough to heal sometimes. So good luck.
And thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Our guest today, Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network. Taking a look at your pet's health with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical professor at the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. Larry Mueller here. And lots of callers online and lots of emails. So we're going to get right to it here and go to Sandy in Fox Lake. And Sandy, your turn. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I have a 4-year-old golden doodle female who was spayed at a very young age. And about 2 months ago, she started leaking urine.
Okay.
And my vet said that this is common in, I don't know if she said large breed spayed females.
Mm-hmm.
And then she prescribed what you call, for short, the pee-pee pill.
Okay.
And it's the phenylpropanolamine.
Phenylpropanolamine, yes, yes.
And she's been on that for maybe about a month and hasn't had any reoccurrence. Will she need to be on this for her entire life?
Most likely. It's very common for spayed female dogs to develop this as a problem. The analogy that I use, the human analogy, is as women get older, that's why there's so many things like poise pads and depend pads and so on like that on the market, because there are, they believe, estrogen receptors on the bladder sphincter. And so combinations of the bladder sphincter being a little weaker, them sleeping and relaxing, and they just end up using, you know, losing a little bit of urine, usually when they're laying down. That's typically where you'll see it, in their bed where they're laying down. Of the two methods of treatment, one is using phenylpropanolamine, and that is a drug that, as a side effect, helps tighten up the bladder sphincter. One of the other things it does, though, is it can increase blood pressure. For normal young dogs that don't have any other underlying health problems, we rarely ever see hypertension being an issue. But as your dog gets older, that would be something that will need to be monitored, because we don't want to be giving a medication that's going to be raising a blood pressure on a dog that's got a disease that's raising the blood pressure. The other type of drug that we'll use is estrogen. And low-dose estrogen is, considered to be very safe. There is rare reported cases of bone marrow suppression, but at the level we're using it at, and if you use it infrequently, typically it's used once a day for like 5 to 7 days, and then maybe once a week after that, that seems to be a very effective way of keeping this dog from leaking, and doesn't have the same side effects as increasing blood pressure. So between either of those drugs, I think, some vets prefer one over the other, and I usually start with estrogen and then switch to phenylpropanolamine if estrogen doesn't work, or use the two of them in combination.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thanks very much for calling. Email from Dee, who says, I have a 5-month-old Sheltie with his dew claws. I'm thinking of having them removed when he's neutered, My vet is hesitant and suggests we wait to see if they cause problems. Would you agree or disagree?
Well, you know, it really depends on what the dew claws are like. If you were to everybody look at their own hand and look at how your thumb acts, it's all bone on bone, and you've got joints that it holds it up nice and tight next to your wrist here. That is what I would call an articulating dew claw in a dog. So some dogs have very tight dew claws that are, you know, fully boned, attached up nice and tight, will probably never cause the dog any troubles with normal lifestyle. You know, and we do see some dogs, though, that instead of having all the bones in their that little thumb like they should have, they only have kind of like if you pictured your thumb with just the bone at the very end where the nail is and everything else from that point on being just kind of floppy skin, you could see how you could get into trouble because now you've got just this little, you know, floppy thing hanging around and they can get caught on things a little more easily. So if they're dangly dew claws, not fully articulated dew claws, maybe not a bad idea to get them taken off because they may cause some trouble because the nail tends to be a little more hook-like and cause problems. Fully articulated dew claws, at this point in the dog's life, leave them on. This is something that breeders will usually do when puppies are 2 or 3 days of age. They snip them off because it's hard to anticipate what the dew claw is going to be like when they're 2 or 3 days of age. So it's a nice simple procedure to do. But now, as a puppy, it's an amputation and it's going to take a while to heal and it's a much more involved surgery.
On to Jane in Gillett. Hi, Jane.
Hi.
Thanks for calling. What can we do for you?
We have a very much beloved beagle who was a foundling. He had been running loose. He was starving. He went to the shelter. We got him 3 days later.
Okay.
Well, it is 5 years later, and he is one of your coffee table dogs.
Okay.
My daughter, who loves him dearly, says that he is a believes that he is always afraid he's going to be starving if there isn't food available. So she keeps him bowl loaded.
Oh.
And as a result, I guess, on his belly, he's got lumps.
Okay.
And the vet tells us they are simply fat deposits and not to worry about them. My daughter's positive he's got cancer and they're not telling her the truth.
Okay. Well, I tell you what you need to do. One of the more common kind of masses that we will see on dogs' bodies are these tumors called lipomas. They're benign, fatty tumors. Even slender dogs will get them. It's not based on metabolism or existing body fat. In fact, if you were to put your dog on a diet, if these truly were lipomas, they would stay there. They may start to look a little bit bigger because you can see them easier, but they are not affected by metabolism at all. When you surgically remove these, which typically you don't have to do unless cosmetically they're not appealing to you, which I don't think is a good reason for surgery, or they're in a spot like in an armpit or underneath where a harness rubs and they're getting irritated, sometimes those cases will take them out. But when you do get them out, you're looking at them after they've been removed, they just look like a perfect little round ball of fat. The way you make a diagnosis is you do what's called a needle biopsy, putting a little needle in, same size that we would use to give a vaccination, and just get some of the cells out of these little lumps and put it on a slide and have a look under the microscope. If you see fat, nothing to worry about. But I think every new lump needs to be looked at because there's other types of tumors that look like lipomas and feel like lipomas to, you know, without looking at the cells. But when we get the cells out, we find out it's something different. And so every new lump should be checked. With my patients that have multiple lumps, I keep what's called a body map, which is a page that's got a picture of the dog in all different, you know, just a kind of cartoon drawing of a dog, all different postures, laying on their back, you know, looking down at them and so on, right side, left side. And then we mark in any new lumps and measure them and date them and tell what the biopsy is. And that way we don't have to go back and keep rebiopsying new lumps the old lumps all the time. So that may be what it is, but get your dog on a diet. Yes, you can do it. Okay. They're going to live longer and be happier and have better joints. And, you know, you can find lots of ways to keep your dog entertained besides with food. So work with your vet on that.
Thanks very much for calling, Jane. Appreciate it. Maria in Rhinelander emails, has a 1-year-old Labradoodle, progressively eats less and less, started after the death of our older dog, our older lab. It's like she's not interested in food. Otherwise, happy, healthy, runs about 4 miles 3 to 4 times a week.
Okay. And if she's not losing weight and is everything you said happy and healthy, and if her weight is normal, it could just be that she's a year old, kind of gone through that puppy growth phase where they have a much better appetite. And the fact that you've lost an older dog, remember, a lot of eating for dogs involves social activity, and we call this social facilitated eating, where one dog is eating and the other dog says, I better eat because, you know, this dog's eating and I may not get my food. So sometimes they can be a lot more food motivated if there's some competition there. So if she's happy and healthy and everything is normal and her weight's staying stable, then it may just be her and nothing to worry about.
All right, let's move to Michael in Ferryville then. Hi, Michael.
Yeah, hi. I actually have a question. This is just something that I'm not sure how to make of it, and I don't know if there's research out there, and maybe you could just answer it. But I have two Siberian Huskies, and I run usually on average in the winter about 60 miles a week and upwards of 80 miles a week with them. They go out for every single run with me. They're my running buddies.
Okay.
So, and the one of them, a pure white, it's kind of like white with a little bit of gold. Anyway, it's really nice dog. It just... it does have some tail chasing kind of aspects to it when I'm, say, in a rut, or if I was injured per se and I hadn't been running for 2 weeks, that dog will start acting up.
Yeah.
But through heavy workloads, it seems to totally naturally, what I'm trying to say is it seems like a natural drug for the dog.
Yeah.
And I'm just wondering if there's studies that show that that is definitely the case if a dog's working hard, say an Australian Shepherd that actually is shepherding, on a daily basis.
Well, my favorite quote is, a tired dog is a well-behaved dog. And, you know, they always use this little phrase, the runner's high, that when you're really working hard, you're releasing endorphins, which are those feel-good hormones that make you feel good. So the more you run, the better you feel. Well, dogs have those as well. And one of the thoughts is on dogs with compulsive disorders is that when they do these repetitive motions over and over and over again, they're getting release of endorphins. In fact, animals with compulsive disorders, you can use a drug that blocks those endorphins blocks it, and they will actually stop the behavior. So it's probably just a function that you've got excellent athletic dogs, and then they become, you know, totally bored and stir crazy, and they start looking for anything they can do to get that same feeling again. So it looks like you're never going to be able to stop running, or you're going to have to get a doggy treadmill, and they do make those, by the way.
Okay.
So.
All right. Good luck. Thank you very much for your call. Steve and Brown Deer, on to you now. Hi, Steve.
Hi. We've got two cats. They're both girls, and they're both fixed. They're about 8 years old, and we have three litter boxes, and they're all three clean twice a day, and we occasionally find that they've peed on a wall or in the hallway, and it's usually a couple spots, and one of the spots is about 3 feet away from the litter box in the basement, and we're not quite sure what to do. I'm sure a lot of cat owners have this problem, but
yeah. If they're actually going on the wall, that sounds more like urine marking. And so when we have cats that are doing that, it's usually because they're socially stressed and they're just feeling like, you know, I kind of equate it to graffiti in inner cities, you know, where there may be more crowding and stressors in life than you would have in a rural area. You know, you're going to see more graffiti in areas like that. Well, cats don't know how to work a spray paint can. So they use their next best thing. They spray urine around and they make everything smell like them. So that could be part of it. And so what needs to be addressed is how well these two cats get along with each other. If there's stray cats outside that could be driving this, because sometimes a cat looking in the window or something could be a trigger. If they're hearing, seeing, or smelling any other cats, those are all triggers as well. So that would be one thing to address. If you haven't already plugged in like a feel-away atomizer, I definitely consider doing that. There, you can go around and find biologic secretions like urine using a black light, and they actually make one commercially that they call the stink finder, so that you can make sure that you clean those areas really well with a good enzymatic cleaner. And then, you know, the other things to be addressing is, you know, where the litter boxes are located. If it's near competitive areas, like it's near the food, or, you know, it's you know, in a highly contested area, like this is where I like to play or sleep, you may start seeing more problems with that. So, you know, increasing the amount of resources. Yes, you've got three litter boxes, but if they're all in one area in the basement, that may create some stress. They should be in three different areas of your home, preferably in areas where they may be choosing to urinate. So making sure you have litter boxes upstairs and downstairs. Basements can be a little scary for cats. That's where all the equipment is, like furnaces and water softeners and so on. So, you know, easy access with, you know, kind of a non-stressful area. So you don't want to have it next to the washing machine or next to their food bowl. But, you know, so start looking at where you can put the litter boxes to maybe, you know, cut down on some of the stressors too.
All right. Thanks again for calling. Appreciate your call. We have another email from a listener who has a 3-year-old rescued border collie. Because people seem to gravitate to her wherever we go, I thought she'd make a perfect therapy dog. She's not a typical border collie. She's very laid back, gentle, incredibly social, absolutely non-aggressive. She's trying to find a place where she can get involved in therapy work in southeast Wisconsin. Any tips on how to get started? Is there some sort of screening process? Also wonders about health issues. Can diseases from people be transferred to dogs or vice versa?
Wow, wow.
And then another one is shedding. She does shed, and would hospitals or retirement homes discourage dogs that shed?
Yes, okay. So if we actually have at the veterinary school, group of students, faculty, and some outside people that have, it's called Pet Pals, and they take their pets over to the university hospital, children's hospital. And things that we screen for are obviously they need to be bathed before they go over there, so you cut down on shedding and their coat is clean. They need to be fully vaccinated, especially for kennel cough, because Bordetella is like whooping cough in people, and some people are going to be maybe immunocompromised that may be contacting these pets. They have to be parasite-free, treated with, you know, flea and tick products and so on. One of the things that you may want to look into is initially getting your dog a canine good citizen rating. And you can do that through your local dog training clubs. And they periodically offer this at, you know, certain events and so on. And that's a good way to test your dog to just see if it is a good citizen and it can pass certain criteria. I know that the dogs that we take in on our program have to go through some intensive testing with people in wheelchairs being pushed towards them, dropping pans, making noises. They can't be barky, drooly, you know, real jumpy. And, you know, probably 9 out of 10 dogs that try out that are excellent dogs, people think would be good therapy dogs, never make it. So don't want to discourage you, but I think that, you know, it's, you know, get started on it. And first of all, get that canine good citizenship rating.
And Sally in Sun Prairie's 11-year-old Shih Tzu was diagnosed yesterday with hyperkalemia via blood work. His renal labs were normal, so the vet next wants to test him for Addison's disease.
Yeah.
Can be a life-threatening situation. Can hyperkalemia be caused by anything else?
Well, those would be the two. Hyperkalemia means high potassium level. And the two most common causes for that are kidney disease. And so getting full blood work and a urinalysis and so on to make sure that there's nothing else going on that way. Then the other thing is this condition called Addison's disease, which is a low producing, hormone producing adrenal gland. It is life threatening. It's an easy thing to be testing for. So I think that, you know, going back and having that evaluated, because even though, you know, you'd think, oh, one little electrolyte potassium being up isn't that much of a problem, it can severely affect the heart rate of your dog and so on. So it can be life threatening. So I think following up would be a good idea.
Ken in Keenan, Wisconsin, we're on to you now. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Sandy.
Hi.
I've got a question regarding my 3-year-old golden doodle. I'm disabled on Social Security and fixed income type situation. And I normally have groomed Boomer here by myself, clipping him. And I just can't anymore because of my arthritis.
Yeah.
And I checked with my local vet for grooming, and they said, sure, you know, no problem. We can do it for $45.
Yeah.
But then we've got to do a wellness checkup, and we've got to check for parasites, and he's going to need this shot and that shot and that shot.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And my $45 grooming turned into $178.
Yeah, yeah.
My question is there anything available through the veterinary schools or free clinics where dogs can be taken and checked over and possibly even groomed that
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. First of all, why did your veterinarian ask to have all this stuff done before grooming? You would think, why? Well, number one, remember, grooming is day boarding, and your dog's going to be in a situation where it's going to be exposed to other dogs and would be putting those other dogs at risk, or your dog could be at risk of picking up other diseases. Rabies vaccination is the law, and I know at the veterinary school, we won't touch a dog unless it's current on its rabies, because if they were to bite us, then we're looking at putting this dog into quarantine. So, there's reasons why this has to be done, and so I'm glad your dog now has a clean bill of health and is all set and ready to go. But, that's real important stuff to keep up on, because you want to have your dog living a long time. And so the wellness stuff is really important. When it comes to, is there, discount areas where you can get grooming, you may want to check and just see if there's any grooming schools in the area. I know that there's some in Wisconsin. I spoke at one that's over by Conmawak several years ago. They may be able to have student grooming sessions, and I don't know if they will take dogs like that. I'm kind of speaking off the top of my head, but that would be some place to look. I know that our veterinary technician school here, MATC in Madison, they offer things like discount dentistries and things so the technicians that are going to school can learn to put IV catheters in, manage anesthesia. There are veterinarians on staff that work with them, but they get to do the cleaning and so on. So there are ways of getting around this. And even vaccines, you may find that there are rabies clinics and other places, but most of those places, they're probably not going to be doing a full physical exam on your dog. So, I think you're still going to need to be able to find a veterinarian. Look into getting pet insurance. That's one way of being able to have a set fee and yet, being able to have all those unexpected things covered in case emergencies do come up.
Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And Tony in Mount Horeb, we're on to you now. Hi, Tony.
Good morning. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
Just came back from the vet, actually, and she's suggesting alternating two topical cat treatments during flea and tick season. That would be Advantage year-round every month,
mm-hmm.
and Frontline for ticks just during the tick season. And you would kind of alternate during the summertime tick season with the Frontline.
Okay.
Every 2 weeks, the cat would be getting something, in other words, during the tick season.
Yeah.
That sound like the protocol or the normal?
Well, Frontline is a monthly product that gets fleas and ticks. So what you could do is use that in the summer months and spring and summer and fall when ticks are out.
Mm-hmm.
And then if, fleas tend to be not a big problem in the middle of winter, unless you've got a cat that's a hunter and is killing prey and their fleas are jumping onto your cat. Then in those months when the ticks are all quiet and hibernating under the leaf litter covered up with snow, then
sure.
That would be the time to consider just using a flea-specific agent that is, that is Advantage. Another product that I like to use in indoor-outdoor cats is called Revolution, which gets fleas, is not super great about with ticks, but it's not bad. Also gets ear mites and scabies and intestinal parasites, and heartworm, which is a risk for cats as well. So that might be another one to talk to your veterinarian about. But I think that's overkill, keeping them on Advantage year-round and throwing Frontline in at the same time.
Thank you for your trouble.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. And Kay in Door County wonders, says a border collie with vestibular disease on prednisone, and the vet said she may have to be on that forever for the rest of its life.
Vestibular disease is a problem with the balance system. And remember, there's two parts to that, in the brain and also out in the ear area. And I'm not sure where this dog has its problem. If it's a central vestibular disease problem, it could have a brain tumor or something triggering this. And then you're looking at long-term steroid use to defer just quality of life.
And the prednisone can remain or something for...
If you're looking at if it's got a brain tumor, it may be lifetime, even though the life is going to be very shortened.
Yeah. Sandy, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
The time flew by.
It does.
And you'll be back next month sometime.
I will be, usually second Tuesday.
Yeah. Usually the second Tuesday. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical professor at the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm sorry, we've got a whole flood of emails and all kinds of calls online, but we just couldn't get to everybody today. That's what usually happens. We'll try to do better next time. Well, we did pretty darn good. I think we got through a lot of calls and a lot of emails. And thank you very much for listening, and stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.